Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Martin Fuel, Head of Communications at the Metropolitan Police. The Met is the UK's biggest and busiest police force. And as Director of Comms and Media, Martin sets the public engagement strategy, advises the management on crises, and of course runs their entire media operation. Joining the Met in 2012, he previously worked in journalism. He was Deputy Editor at Channel 4 News, Daytime Editor at BBC News 24, and before that worked on programmes such as PM and The World at One on Radio 4. He also advises the National Lead for Counter-Terrorism, and last year facilitated the major BBC One documentary, The Met, Policing London. Martin, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Paul. Good to see you.
Is your job the best media job in the world or the worst? Because it is quite unique, isn't it?
I think if you're interested in news and if you're interested in communication and the way people behave, it's got to be one of the best. I'm not saying it's easy. It's incredibly challenging. Communicating on behalf of any police force, I think, is difficult, but particularly so if you police a very big city. But it's very challenging and very exciting. And I'm surrounded by a great team of people, both my communicators, but also the senior officers and staff I work with, who challenge me every single day of the week.
And how big is your team then? And how does the operation work behind the scenes?
We've got about 80 people now. And between those 80 people, we have to provide media support to the 32,000 police officers who police London. It's a huge city, 8.5 million people. The Met is not just the biggest police force in the UK, it's the biggest in Europe. And we have a huge range of responsibilities. And there's huge interest in it from journalists and huge interest from the public. And we engage a lot with the public. So about half of those team are taking inquiries from media every day of the week. We get somewhere between 1,300 and 1,600 inquiries a week from local journalists, national journalists, and of course, even international journalists. And that's probably the primary job, at least for the media side of our team. I'm very happy to go on and talk about what we do on internal comms, engaging our leaders, culture change, how you market the Met to London and all the issues that go with that, and some of the digital things we're doing as well. But I guess most people will think of us in terms of our engagement with the media. Naturally, we're a very prominent, visible organisation across all forms of media.
Unusually, though, for a kind of media operation, that if you give out some incorrect information or in terms of information that you shouldn't give out, that could compromise a trial or create serious legal ramifications. So in a sense, the stakes are quite high with your operation because you've got to get it right, but you've also got to make sure that you don't reveal anything that's secret. How does that work?
Very good question. And actually, the stakes are probably even higher than you describe, because occasionally, not all the time, you know, policing is also about life and death as well. And particularly if we're trying to do communications around an ongoing incident or a crisis, we have to be mindful that what we say is intended to help the public protect themselves. But yes, there are other issues, legal issues as well. The actual kind of model which we operate with effectively gives the sign-off responsibility for all the communications we put out to the police officer who's in charge of that incident or that investigation. I think it happens with a lot of corporate organisations, but it's particularly important. So we shouldn't be releasing information unless the police officer who's involved in that incident is happy for it to be released, because we're not to know what might compromise their investigation and what the impact of it might be. And it's not just about issues of libel or defamation or compromising a court process.
Protection of witnesses and all that kind of thing.
There's a whole load of other issues.
Not tipping off criminals. They know, you know, actually the Rozzas are on their way to arrest them right now.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you've got to protect your evidence. If you're doing an investigation, people may challenge you, why are you investigating this? What's it all about? And of course, it's very tempting to say, well, actually, we know this. But you really want to need to save that moment until the appropriate point in your investigation, perhaps when you're going to question a suspect or ultimately when you come to court. If you show your hand, you're only going to help the people you're investigating. So that's one challenge. And then, of course, you're also dealing with a lot of confidential information, confidential very often to the person who's been a victim of crime or indeed as a suspect as well. And we take very seriously our responsibilities to protect the confidentiality of the individuals involved. So you've got that issue as well. And then, as you've already suggested, police tactics are really important to protect. And I think all of these things make it a real challenge when you do what we have been doing over the last 3 or 4 years, which is trying to bring a great deal more transparency to policing. our commissioner, Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, really set out his stall and said, I want to be more transparent. I want people to have a better understanding of policing. And that's why he, for example, said to the BBC, come in and make a big documentary series about us.
We'll
give you
fantastic
top-to-bottom access to the Met, which we did because we wanted to be transparent. But equally, we've got to have some pretty strict, clear rules about what we don't communicate. Sometimes that could be really frustrating from a media handling point of view. You may be being attacked for the quality of your investigation. You're bound to upset people. You know, if you're investigating somebody, whoever they are, frankly, they're not going to be very happy. And they may go out and say, well, the police are doing this, they're doing that. And you have to grit your teeth and say, there will come a moment when this will come to court or may not, when we are able to respond to that criticism and show the evidence that we have got. But up until that point, it's really important that sometimes, I'm afraid, you maintain a dignified silence. That can be very frustrating for journalists. I suspect it can be frustrating for the public at times. I'm afraid it goes with the territory.
Yeah, because it must be frustrating for you knowing that, you know, that there's some mega criminal on the loose and actually you've got him under surveillance and you're going to arrest him in the next few days, but then the sun will splash in, the Met are doing nothing on this, and you feel like saying, well, we're doing a lot actually, but I can't tell you about it. It must be very frustrating.
Yeah, generally I wouldn't know that kind of thing. I mean, the Met and other police forces are organisations that have to be very careful in how they share information, even within the organisation. It really operates on a need-to-know basis. Mm. So, yes, I have got press officers who work very, very closely with the operational police officers and at times do need to be told before something's happened, you know, what we are planning so that we can make the appropriate media plans. You know, the officers, rightly, I think, are careful in how they guard the information. And indeed, they put almost the media aspect of it last. You know, we are going to do what we're going to do. Now, media team, can you help us explain it to the public?
I think, in fairness, that's probably the right order, frankly.
I think it has to be. It's why, for example, and I'll be cheeky at the moment, I thought Babylon. Did you see Babylon on Channel 4?
I didn't, sadly.
No, okay. So Babylon was a series that it was a great idea of Danny Boyle's, who came in to talk about his idea. I thought had a very interesting thesis behind it, which is how police forces and other organisations can no longer control information. And he's partly right about that, because social media, digital media, means that mainstream media and big, powerful organisations don't have the control they once had. Equally, actually, we do still have control over a lot of the confidential information we have. But the broad thesis was really interesting. So this was a comedy set in a force that was very similar to the Met.
Yes.
albeit with a head of comms who was considerably more exciting and attractive than the real Met's head of communications. But the one bit that I thought, hey, that's not quite right, is I think they had a view that police communications would be a bit like political communications are at times, where everything you do or say is governed by how you want to come across. I think that's a bit of a caricature of politics, to be honest. Mm. You engage with politicians or not, and that's not how most of them behave. But that's the caricature. It's the thick of it. It's Spin City. It's West Wing. It's how does this look? And then what should we do?
So this isn't just West Wing with handcuffs?
No. I think policing is very much about what's the right thing to do here, and then let's explain it. And that makes life challenging for us. But I think, as you said, that's the way it should be.
So you mentioned that the commanders of any particular operation are very much autonomous, but how does it work in terms of, do they inform you they've made an arrest and then you release it to the press, or do you... Because I know one of the things that you personally have advocated is that you want the actual officer commanding to be the person on air who's on screen communicating it, rather than, say, you, for example, being a kind of police spokesperson.
Yes, certainly. I don't go out and talk about operational activity, and I don't think I should. I think the public want to hear the people who make those decisions, and those are police officers. And I'm absolutely convinced that's the right way it should be. Of course, my team will talk to journalists on the phone and they will give them statements and respond to questions. But if it comes to fronting up by doing an interview in the media about police activity, whether that's print media or broadcast media, that's a job for officers. I think it's fair to say that to a certain extent, officers have gone into their shell a little bit over the last few years because of all the fuss.
Post-Leveson.
All the fuss around phone hacking, and the allegations that journalists were paying police officers for information. And it's naturally made police officers a bit cautious. My boss has a really clear message to our officers, which is he does want them to talk to journalists. He wants them to have an open, professional, relationship with the media. And it's vital for us to do that for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, if you follow the British model of policing, which we call policing by consent, so we don't try and enforce the law with having tens of thousands of armed police officers like they do in other jurisdictions. Of course, we have some, but that's not our standard method of policing. We rely on having the support of the public for what we do. And we only get that if we engage with them in lots of different ways, as communities, geographical communities, as ethnic communities, as racial groups, as business, as whatever interest they may
have. Online,
even. Yes. And we engage with them. And so we require our officers to be good at communicating externally, whether that's in social media, as a lot of our officers are doing now, or indeed whether it's via traditional media. So that's the first reason. And I think the second reason is we want journalists, whether they're local or national, to be well informed about issues involving policing. News is written by a lot of people now, and with the best will in the world, we would rather the news about us were written by people who understood what some of the issues were. So, for example, we were dealing with a big investigation a year and a half ago where there was a possibility that the suspect had fled the UK and gone to a different country. That sounds simple. Well, he must be in that country. Why don't you just go and get him? All the issues involved in dealing with somebody else's jurisdiction, where British police officers have no powers whatsoever, and then dealing with the complexities of international arrest warrants, was something that we took great pains to try and explain to the media and to the journalists who work with us most closely, so that they could write informed stories. But to a casual eye, it all looks very simple. Why can't you just get that person back? Why haven't you done it already? Why aren't you there straight away? Or actually, you need to negotiate a whole set of different permissions with whichever country you're going to, and then you need to work through a legal process to do what you want to do. And that's why we need journalists who understand those issues, so that we get a fair hearing. And that's all we want. You know, my boss is really clear. I want a fair hearing. Sometimes we get things wrong. If we get criticised for that, fair enough. But I hope that people will understand the complexities of the challenges that individual police officers face, let alone the more senior officers. So when they write about us or broadcast about us, what they do is fair. And for the most part, that's exactly what happens.
Do you get a fair hearing? I mean, it's not an invitation to grumble, as it were, but it's a genuine question because, I mean, I served 6 years in local politics in my former hometown of York. And I remember when I first got elected, I kind of befriended Kevin Booth, who was the then editor of the York Press. Mm. He's now editor of the Leicester Mercury. But he told me once, as a kind of friend, he said that, look, the council doing a good job is never going to be news, whereas we can always splash every day with, oh, the council's mucked up again. So I kind of knew straight away that we were never going to get a totally fair hearing. Yes, we might get a point to kind of do a bit of rebuttal, but we weren't guaranteed that fair hearing. Do you think the media are kind of mischievously against you from the outset?
I think that's a challenge, frankly, for all organisations that, if you like, are part of the establishment or have any power, whether it's politicians, as you've just described, whether it's big media organisations, for example, you know, you look at the way the BBC is reported, or whether it's big corporate organisations. You know, it didn't take that long for Google from being the organisation that did no evil across the world to being put on somebody's hate list, for example, you know, for whatever reason it might be. And so police, in one sense, are no different from that. All organisations are targets for investigative journalism, and often for commentary as well. And in some respects, that's how it should be, and we don't mind that. We accept that. I think there are some particular challenges at the moment that affect policing. You know, our relationship with journalists has changed. It used to be, frankly, a bit cosier. There used to be more informal briefing, and to a certain extent, unofficial and official releases of information to favoured journalists, which in the end didn't help our reputation. And when that was exposed during the Leveson process, I think people looked at it and were a bit shocked. You know, the modern civic culture, if you like, political culture, expects a much greater degree of transparency from public bodies about what they say and how they say it.
It was felt to be altogether too cosy, wasn't it?
Yes, and it created a perception that because we were thought to have cosy relationships with certain media organisations, that might impact on the investigative judgments we made. And you cannot afford that to happen as a police force, whether it's about media organisations, about politicians, about any organisation. If you're perceived to be too close to them, then people will look at the decisions you make when you're doing an investigation and say, well, we know why they've made that decision, don't we? And the Met, unfortunately, was in that position, rightly or wrongly, that was how it was perceived. So it's really important that we drew up a set of rules, which we have, as police forces have done across the UK, that are open, clear, you can read them on our website, and the vast majority of the communication we now do with media organisations is open,
it's
in statements, etc. Occasionally we need to talk to people in private. We've done a lot over the past year about some of the terrorist challenges we face. You know, the threat level changed a year and a half ago. We had a series of incidents in Paris first, at Charlie Hebdo, other countries in the world. And as you can tell, there's been quite a significant reevaluation of what the threat is to the UK and a significant change to the way the police are dealing with that. Now, we've taken journalists into our confidence a lot over the past year about the implications of that. They have worked really well with us, I think, because some of this affects how they report on us and what they might do if we had a Paris-type incident here.
Mm.
We've had a really good response for them. But it wouldn't be appropriate to discuss all of that in public. Apart from anything else, we might have to indicate something of our understanding of how terrorist organisations work and what they might do. And it just wouldn't be appropriate to talk about that publicly. And that's where we depend on a relationship of trust with media and other organisations as well, so we can have those conversations as much as anything else to get their perspective on how they might respond in these situations and what we might do to work with them successfully. So there are occasions when you need to have a private conversation, but for the most part, we'll be out there, we'll be on the record, and we will explain why we've what we've done, and we'll do it in a way that anybody can see. Because apart from anything else, the idea that you can manage your media coverage by a small coterie of journalists, whether you're politicians, police, whoever now, is gone. Anybody can write about you. Anybody can broadcast about you. And some people who are not in mainstream media will clearly get considerable traction with what they say. And yet they don't have time to come to your briefings. They don't necessarily know all the background to it. So you have to be open source, if you like, in terms of explaining why you've done what you do. You can't just rely upon people already understanding, you know, the way police operate or turning up to get a briefing to understand why you've taken the decisions you have. So there's a whole set of reasons which have changed the way in which organisations like ours have to engage with journalists. And I think actually they're a lot bigger than some of the factors that came out of Leveson.
Yeah, I want to explore those issues in a little bit more depth later on. But if I could just bring you back to the kind of mechanics of the operation as well. I mean, the first question that springs to mind there is about if people make a mistake. So, for example, if the Sun would say, yes, there's a rapist on the loose and we're looking for someone who, you know, has brown hair and you know that they've got blonde hair, do you have a mechanism to correct them to make sure that people aren't being given the wrong information? And do you have a separate playbook? For example, if a columnist in the Times makes a criticism of your media department and says you have 130 staff, when I know it's around 80, and you think, well, that's factually inaccurate, do you kind of have a kind of proactive error correction? Because one is obviously very much strongly in the safety of the public interest and one's very much about the reputational prestige of the Met. Do you kind of handle those separately?
No, I think both of those examples you've given are about factual inaccuracies. Whether it's a suspect being described in the wrong way or whether it's a fact given or presented about the Met Police, any aspect of it, which we know to be incorrect. I think in both those situations, we would go back to the media organisation and say, you've got that wrong, please could you correct it?
And do you have a kind of proactive media monitoring operation at that point? I mean, obviously, like we all do, you read the papers and you must spot things that are wrong. But presumably, as well, on social media, if there's an inaccuracy and it gains some traction, it would then come to your attention that way.
Yes, we do monitor media. And as I say, we do contact media organisations and indeed we contact people in social media and say, that's factually wrong. Here's what the truth is. Please, will you use it instead? And most of the time, they're pretty good and will respond. Very rarely, we will escalate a complaint to a higher level. So, you know, over the past year or so, 2 years or so, we've had some issues with a couple of broadcast organisations. In one case, the complaint went to the regulator. In another case, the broadcaster apologised and we didn't need to escalate it any higher. And because I think it's really important that we get fair treatment. I mean, that's what we're asking for. We're asking for fair coverage. And I think it's important with organisations like the police or the NHS or local authorities, social services department, that people don't think they can say whatever they like about them, kind of irrespective of the facts. So we don't do it very often, and we don't want to curtail freedom of expression. We really firmly believe that a very important part of what the Met Police does is not just to protect the public in London, but it's to protect the UK as a place where liberal democracy can thrive. You know, we're part of that democracy as well. And we want all those elements that make up democracy to flourish. That's part of what we do. Every now and then we'll say, we don't think that's right, please could you correct it?
You talked about empowering the commanders of the operations to speak to the media directly. Do you kind of media train them then? Do you tell them what a good briefing would be and what wouldn't? I mean, obviously, for the operational details are up to them, but there are certain things that you would need to teach them in terms of having a tie that's TV safe, where to look, how to come across. There must be some mechanics of dealing with the media that they need to be made aware of.
But to be fair, I think it's been part and parcel of training for police officers for some time. I mean, media can often play an important role in the operational strategy of an investigative officer. So typically, if you're investigating a murder, for example, right from the outset, you'd be thinking, what's our media strategy around this? As soon as a murder happens, there's going to be media interest. So at the very least...
And you need the media to harness the public's enthusiasm
exactly.
to catch that person
exactly.
and tip you off.
The media, traditional media, mainstream media, has always been a powerful tool for investigating officers. Social media has made it even more powerful. And the best example of that is the way we work with officers to try to find missing people. We put out an extraordinary number of missing person appeals on behalf of families, relatives, anxious about their loved ones. I think one afternoon last week, we put out 8 appeals from Scotland Yard in about 3 hours.
Wow.
And social media is very successful at circulating those images and getting a response from the public. We also get a very good response when we put out video. And again, we will use social channels as much as mainstream media to put out video, usually CCTV, of suspects who have been captured on camera, either in the course of committing an offence or leaving it, who our officers want to trace. It's a very, very powerful tool. You know very well how much modern social media thrives on engaging video, and the police have got an awful lot of it. And so my point is that a media strategy has always been part and parcel of an investigator's armoury of tools that they can use alongside forensic and the rest. So it's not a question of us having to wake them up to that possibility. I mean, we can educate them as to the additional possibilities that now exist with social media. So I'll give you one very good example. We use targeted social media advertising to get our appeals to reach into particular communities, sometimes in this country, sometimes around the world. So we were investigating an historic murder not that long ago where the suspect was believed to have fled to Nigeria. So we worked with the investigating officers to target adverts at the place in Nigeria where we thought he was.
Incredible.
And lo and behold, not that long after, a matter of days afterwards, somebody recognised him, contacted the Nigerian police, and he was arrested, subsequently extradited, brought back here and convicted.
So fantastic work.
We're utilising tools that corporate organisations would understand quite well now for a policing purpose. So, of course, there are things we can do with officers to enhance their media strategy. But I think every police officer, certainly those doing a serious investigation, would understand that's part and parcel of the job. Now, of course, there's a bit of practical media training that goes with that, and we do a bit of that, and it helps people. I think anybody who wants to communicate using broadcast media would benefit from practice and some coaching. And actually, we also do quite a lot of training. In fact, our most extensive training program at the moment is around social media.
Last question on the mechanics then. If you've got an operational commander that wants to reach out to the media, do you facilitate that, or do they kind of build up their own networks, or did you give them a kind of email list of, and they send their own email? How does it actually work?
We would certainly facilitate contacts with national and international media with whom they're unlikely to have an ongoing relationship. If they're operating at a local level...
And they know the local crime
and dealing with local media, then we would encourage them and support them to have that relationship. I'm not saying that they're constantly on and off the phone with the reporter from the local newspaper or TV or radio station. They're not. But they should know them. They should be able to speak to them. I think the challenge we face here, and it's a really significant challenge that I'm sure you'll be aware of, is the number of journalists working in local media is shrinking. And the number of people who've got the time to engage with us and understand our issues, I think, is diminishing. that's a challenge for us about who do we actually engage with. Now, having said that, the requirement is also changing as well. So local newspapers are obviously developing their online presence in a very significant way. And when I go out and talk to them and say, well, what do you need from us? And this applies to national newspapers as well. They'll say very often video. So that's one of the reasons why we've tried to industrialise our production of video, because our local and indeed our national customers, if you like,
know that that drives
that's
the clicks.
What they want.
Yeah,
it drives clicks. So everybody knows, had always known ever since Charles Dickens, that crime sells newspapers. And of course, it drives traffic to websites as well. So whilst we can't leave our traditional print and broadcast audience behind, and we have to deliver them a service, which we do, we have to find a way with diminished resources to serve digital content to the newer ways of engaging the public. And that means video content, graphic content, etc. But yeah, we want all of our officers to be able to engage with the media, and we would encourage them to do that about the things that are relevant to them.
I've already asked you about what you can and can't say, and I imagine that's quite easy when there's legal reasons for things you can't release or report, so you just don't do it. But are there any kind of more nuanced, kind of more existential issues? I'm thinking, for example, terrorism, where your duty as a force is to reassure people that they can go about their day-to-day basis and not spark panic. But on the other hand, you've got to encourage them to be vigilant, and you've got to present the facts in a calm and reassuring way. How do you kind of get that balance right so that you don't engender panic, but you also keep the public fully appraised?
I think that's a very real challenge. And I suppose there are two points I'd make here. The first thing I would say is that we have changed our approach to the way we communicate around terrorism because of Syria and Iraq and the way in which ISIL operates. I would say previously we had a very cautious approach to communicating information about terrorism. The organisations, terrorist organisations that we were trying to counter, also had a very tight cellular structure. They guarded their information very closely, and we did too. And that was probably very typical until a few years ago. And now you're dealing with effectively an open source organisation which communicates out there in the open, openly tries to radicalise people, openly talks about what it's going to do, and you can't really do the British stiff upper lip thing.
Yes.
And not say very much. You have to engage. You have to help the public understand as much as anything else how the nature of the threat has changed. So we have, under our assistant commissioner who's in charge of counterterrorism, adopted, I think, a much more open approach where we're trying to explain more what we're doing.
Because the terrorists are actually very social media savvy. The reason why they're threatening these people and dressing them in Guantanamo jumpsuits is to engender and attract the very media attention that they want.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we've got to be active in social media as well. And also what we try to do is we're trying to reach out to groups within the community who themselves oppose terrorism and encourage them to get out messaging that might counter the radicalisation attempts of people like ISIL. But I think the other point you make is about getting the balance right between releasing information and not frightening people. And that is
a
really difficult challenge. People are very sensible. They're very rational. They will make decisions based on their own assessment of the threat. So I think we are happy to share information about our perception of the threat. Now, as I said, it's been the case in the UK since August 14 that the threat level says an attack in the UK is highly likely. And that's been the case now for 18 months or so. And I think most of the public are aware of that. It doesn't stop them going about their business. And I think the best illustration of how we try to bridge these two challenges was after the most recent Paris attack and the Bataclan theatre and 130-odd people who died, where we were faced with the challenge of policing a big football match at Wembley on the Tuesday afterwards, which, of course, if you recall, involved the French team. And so there was a degree of concern about it. And naturally, the public were going to be concerned about it. Our officers assessed the threat, decided there was no reason to advise the footballing authorities not to have the match. But of course, we did put out a more visible armed policing presence, untypical for major sporting events, although it wasn't too dissimilar from what we'd done at the Olympics in 2012. And what we do reasonably regularly at major events or airports and places like that. So not completely different, but unusual nevertheless for Wembley. So we needed to be visible there. And the commissioner, I think, was very clear. He went on to Crime Watch the night before and he spoke to the media on the morning of the game and said, look, we will make you as safe as we can. You know, London is one of the safest global cities in the world, not just for terrorism, but for other aspects of violence, be it murder, shooting, stabbings, etc. I'm not saying it's without problems. Of course it is. And any city with 8.5 million people in is going to have some violence. But you really find this most noticeably, I think, if you talk to international visitors to London or foreign people living and working in London, particularly Americans. If you ask Americans what they like about living and working in London, they'll say, I can walk down the street. My family can walk down the street. And when organisations like The Economist go out and ask business people what makes a safe city for them, they put London very high on that list. And the things that they will say is crime is low, there's little or no corruption, so it's a good place to do business, and our people feel safe here, so they want to work here. So the aftermath of Bataclan was a good example of how, on the one hand, we're saying, yeah, we're going to have to reassess the threat to the UK. This has just happened in a major European city. We need to consider the issues for us in terms of policing London. But on the other hand, we will have a visible armed policing presence and you should feel safe to attend this match. And they did, and it passed off successfully. And on the same night, in another European country, they cancelled a football match just before kickoff because they were nervous. So we have good officers. I'm not saying you can guarantee people safety. I'd be foolish to say that, and none of our officers would ever say that. Got to remind people that the threat says an attack is highly likely. But what I think they can take comfort from is the fact that the British police, not least through our history of engaging with terrorism on our own shores, are pretty expert at dealing with this. But only, and this is a final thought on this, only if we get the help of the community and the various different communities. It's very noticeable that we've been getting more information over the past year from communities to help us understand where these threats come from and might police them. That is where the opportunity to thwart terrorists come from. From information, a lot of which you glean from members of the public. And it's really important that people understand that if they're at all concerned about somebody behaving oddly or whatever, disappearing off, coming back, we'd rather they rang us. There's an anti-terrorist hotline, there's a 101 number, and if it's a real emergency, there's a 999 number. We'd rather know about it, and then we can have a look at it. And that kind of relationship with the community is part and parcel why a department like mine exists and why we're constantly trying to find new ways to engage, particularly with minority communities. And I think we're not totally successful at it, but we are successful a lot of the time.
How does it work in terms of media outreach then? So, for example, you mentioned there that there had been the Paris attacks, there was the football match that immediately followed, and you had a much more visible armed police presence at the football match, which is unusual. But do you also, running parallel to that, have some kind of an awareness-raising strategy of that you're not just relying on the cameras to kind of capture the police, that you're actually kind of proactively telling the media, almost like in a PR term, like a press release, saying there will be a much more heavily armed police presence at this? How does that work?
Yes, and that's absolutely what we did on that day, and it's absolutely what we did on New Year's Eve, when, if you recall, there was concern about the possibility of an attack somewhere in Europe. Nobody ever said, we think there's going to be an attack in London, but nevertheless, people thought, oh, how's the Met going to respond to this? And we were clear beforehand that we would have a more visible armed policing presence than normal, because ultimately we want to reassure people. We want to reassure the majority of the public who want to go to events and want to be safe. But equally, we need to make sure that we're able to deal with any potential threat that we can identify.
Just moving on now to the kind of more reputational issues of the Met generally, you were quite instrumental in initiating the BBC One documentary, The Met Policing London. What was the genesis behind that and how did that work?
Well, to be fair, actually, the idea had started running before I joined, and a number of media companies and came in and pitched to the Met ahead of the Olympics. And at that point, the ambition, I think, on their part was to capture the Met during Olympic year. And at that point, the management board and the commissioner felt it would be an unnecessary distraction when we were dealing with a really high-profile event. And clearly, we wanted the security of Londoners and the people visiting that event to come first, didn't want to be distracted by that. So then we revisited the idea the year after the Olympics. And by that time, I was in the Met. And we invited the BBC, who'd been selected as the company we wanted to work with, back in, and they presented their ideas again. And the commissioner and the management board were very clear that they felt it was the right thing to do. They then came in and spent a period of time researching the organisation, trying to understand what they felt would be the stories they'd most want to tell. They filmed, I think, over a year or so or more, and then screened all the episodes last year. From our point of view, it was about being transparent. It was about having the public better informed about some of the challenges that police officers have to deal with. It was about demonstrating that although police officers, like others, are often demonised and mythologised, if you like, as certain types of individual, actually, most of our officers are fantastic, human, warm people.
Normal people doing a good job in difficult circumstances.
Well, absolutely. I can say a bit more than that. You know, we did a bit of work with our managers, our middle managers and our senior leaders a couple of years ago. In the course of that, we looked at what kind of personality types and working styles did we have in the organisation. And what we found was that the majority of officers are very sociable, amiable people. And they come in to work in policing because they love engaging with people. And if you are a police officer, that's what you do. You're dealing with people's problems all the time. And our officers will say, I want to help people. I want to make a difference. I want to help people's problems. Now, of course, there are other different personality types. There are very sort of driven individuals who want to get things done. There are thoughtful, analytical individuals who want to look at problems. And very creative, expressive types as well. But the majority of Met officers are people. And that's what it takes, really. To be a really good police officer, you've got to be able to talk to people who might be undergoing the most awful personal crisis, or you've got to try and break up a conflict. And first and foremost, you'd rather do that by talking, if you can.
I thought it was an incredible documentary. I enjoyed every moment of it. And I mean, I started off kind of pro-police, as it were, but I was even more amazed at the quality of your officers and what you do. You know, I mean, I sometimes go in a mood for the day if someone's rude to me on the tube in the morning, and yet you see some of the kind of hostility and violence that some of your officers are met with, and then the next shot, they're kind of just laughing it off and trying to be lighthearted. They've diffused the situation, or they've arrested their suspect, and then they're on to the next thing, whereas I would probably let that bother me for the rest of the day.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's really good to hear you say that. And
you must have had quite a positive assessment of it then, in terms of the reputational outcomes for the Met. Was it universally kind of welcomed?
Not universally. And you would never expect it to be. But yes, people who watched it felt more positive about the Met at the end of the series than they did at the beginning. And we did do some research because we felt it was important to understand how people felt about us. It was the most extraordinary opportunity, as any organisation would find, to be able to understand what the people you serve think of you. What do they think of the service? What do they think of us? Are there lessons we can learn here? So that's why we did some research around it. And yeah, it showed that people felt more positive at the end than at the beginning, that they thought more highly of the professionalism of officers, their respect for police officers had increased, and their trust had increased. And by and large, they felt more safe at the end of it as well. But there are some challenges there as well. So, for example, the first episode in the documentary series dealt with the Mark Duggan verdict. Mark Duggan, as people will recall, was shot in Tottenham, and subsequent to that, the 2011 riots happened. And there was a big dispute over whether this was a lawful police shooting or not. And that culminated in early 2014 with an inquest verdict of a lawful killing, but a verdict which, it's fair to say, some people didn't accept, and some people, particularly in the community there, felt was at variance with the facts, even though a jury of Londoners, a diverse jury of Londoners, spent weeks listening to the evidence. Nevertheless, understandably, some people weren't convinced by that. That was a really challenging episode, dealing with very, very sensitive issues, a legacy of mistrust between communities and the police, which we're still, frankly, battling with. And it did expose an interesting challenge, and a challenge there that when we asked minority viewers what they thought of that, they felt the Met still looked very white, still lacked some empathy with the community, and they wanted to know more about what the Met was doing, not just to look and feel like London, which is a key ambition of ours, but also to deal with the history around racism and poor relations with minority communities. So that was a challenge for us. And frankly, that was the indicator that I was looking at most closely whilst that series was on. I mean, it's great to have people nationally saying, oh, the Met look good as a result of this. Great. The challenge for us is always about the communities we police. How do they respond? Are we going to be able to engage with them more successfully as a result of any kind of media activity we've done? Now, the very positive thing here is when we ask people, do you feel more positive about the Met as a result of watching this series? That answer came back much more positively from minority viewers. So all viewers increased their positive feelings about the Met during that series. The increase was twice as much amongst minority viewers. Now, the hypothesis behind that is the series showed police officers to be friendly, approachable, humans, dealing with tricky situations, explaining what they were doing. And I think perhaps it countered some of the myths around how police do behave, particularly in areas of London where we have had really tricky relationships over the years. But I think all of our officers can be very proud of the way they came across. They can be proud of their colleagues. And they can see here that if we are able to demonstrate that human, approachable side, we will get a better relationship from any community in London.
In a sense, it's almost a bit of a kind of, if you were doing a media studies degree and you had to kind of write a dissertation, someone could say, you know, you are in charge of media of the Metropolitan Police. How do you move them away from the kind of Stephen Lawrence institutionally racist type thing? What is the media strategy to do that? And I think one of the things that, as you've rightly identified, is just pulling back the curtain, involving people in your day-to-day work. Because if you just say, we're not racist, you know, it's just going to look terrible, isn't it? I mean, there's got to be some kind of strategy behind that. And I think, as you've said, the only way you can do that is to show the force for how it is.
And doing that series was not without risk. I think there was some commentary at the time about who had editorial control of this. Well, let's be clear, BBC had editorial control.
I think it had to be, otherwise it would have just been a...
Not us. They decided what material they wanted to put in their programmes. They decided how to present it. You know, they decided to call the first episode Race and to address the issue of race in the Met, which, frankly, be honest about it, has been our number one challenging issue for many decades. Mm. Now, you know, given a choice, we probably wouldn't have chosen that. Of course we wouldn't. You know, they chose to address that issue head on, and they had editorial control of it. It is a risk allowing cameras to go out on live firearms operations. Mm. You don't know what's going to happen. They followed an incident in the documentary, and it was resolved peacefully. Good. But they aren't all, as you know. We allowed the cameras in to watch senior officers in the Metropolitan Police respond live to the Mark Duggan verdict. Now, as is very evident in that film, we were concerned about the community reaction to that verdict, bearing in mind what happened in 2011. We feared in a worst-case scenario there might be disorder and a reaction to it, and we'd had to plan for that. A different verdict? Who knows what might have happened? That was a big risk. Most organisations would not allow the cameras in at the very point at which they discover something significant that may impact upon their organisation. So we took quite a significant risk, but we did so for all the reasons you describe. We want to open up the way the Met works. We want people to see how they operate. Now, I'm not saying...
So the way to give it the appearance of openness is to actually genuinely be open, as you've just said.
Yes, and that's absolutely right. With that caveat I mentioned before, that we can't always be open about the nature of police investigations. By definition, there has to be some protection of evidence and confidentiality.
Well, one of the things I remember from the documentary is that there was a kind of expert pixelation team. Every shot had, like, even someone's computer monitor, even if it was just in the background, was expertly pixelated. So it was just the monitor. There was so much that you couldn't show.
Yes, that was done by the BBC, but we obviously had to advise them on tactics or information that might compromise our way of investigating. And, of course, there's also the consent issue as well. If you make a big programme like that, it's up to the BBC to get the consent of people before they depict them on the TV. I mean, I think in terms of the bigger issue there you talk about, which is the legacy of our relationships with black communities in particular, I think it's really important to say that the starting point here is not about the Met's media activity. It's about what we do. Mm. It's not enough just to say the right things. It's about what you do. Critically there, We have moved heaven and earth to recruit as many minority police officers as we can. And we've been much more successful over the last couple of years in that. So, for example, it's now the case that you have to have lived in London for three of the previous 6 years if you want to join the Met. Because what we've found was that Londoners, who were always had a high proportion of minorities who wanted to join the Met, were being swamped by people from outside London, where communities are much less likely to include minorities in them. So we've said, you've got to have lived in London. We've also looked at whether we should ask for a second language. I mean, London, as I'm sure you're aware, is an incredible city of minorities now. More than 40% of people in London now would describe themselves as coming from a minority. 300 languages spoken. And so for us as a police force, a police service, rather, to police a city like London, we have to have a service that looks and feels like London and speaks like London as well. Mm. So we definitely need to have people from all communities represented in our ranks. So those have been two very important steps. But of course, they're not the only things we've done. Our commissioner has been very clear that he wanted to reduce the amount of stop search, which has been a long-running issue, as I think everybody's aware, with black communities in particular. And we've reduced it very, very significantly. And in particular, we've reduced the amount of stop searches where we say, OK, we want to use our power to stop and search across a whole area because one incident's happened, known as a Section 60 power. That's the one where we hardly use that at all now. We use what we would call an intelligence-led approach to stopping and searching, where we're not just stopping people randomly. We're acting on the basis of intelligence. So we're being much more successful at making sure we stop the people who we have reason to stop. Of course, you're always going to stop people who have no reason to charge. Unfortunately, that is the nature of using that power. It's in the interest of keeping people safe, whatever community they're from. Because unfortunately, a lot of the communities that suffer most from violence in London, be it knife violence or gun violence, are communities in inner London with high portions of black people living in them. And so we're trying to protect them. There's a lot of support in those communities for using these powers as long as they're used in a fair way. But the key point here is, in the nicest possible way, it's not the preserve of the communication team to communicate a message that is in some way or other not backed up by operational activity and the way our officers operate. That's the critical thing. We've got to behave in the right way. And then, of course, we can tell the public what we're doing.
This is one of those awful striking the balance questions, as it were. But if you take something like Operation Yew Tree, where do you think the balance lies between rightly naming celebrities that have been arrested to allow potential, you know, other victims to come forward? Many celebrity sex offenders, if you can call them that, many of their victims thought they were the only person that was a victim. And part of the publicity around it has allowed those people to come forward and therefore to be put on trial and found guilty. But then there are other people, when their identities are potentially leaked or they eke out into the media, however it is, where they're not charged. But it's such a potentially inflammatory thing to even be arrested for, even if you're not charged. It's one of the gravest things to, you know, insults to be a paedophile. How do you strike that balance?
Well, I think the first thing to say in response to that is that's got to be an operational decision, whether an investigating officer does want to identify somebody prior to them being charged, because when they are charged, they will be named. And actually, in a number of the cases where additional victims have come forward, is the point of charge that has led to that happening. So my job and my team's job is to advise the officers. Ultimately, it's got to be their decision. I think it's only proper, really, that they should respond to that kind of question. But what I would say is the Commissioner of the Met, Bernard Hogan Howe, has made clear in Parliament that he thinks it would be better if people were not named before charge. Because of, I suppose the point about this is, arresting somebody is a long way from charging somebody. To arrest somebody, you need reasonable suspicion. And you may need to arrest them to try to secure evidence, or if you're worried about a potential risk to others, you may want to impose bail conditions, and that may be part of your investigation as well. That's a long way from having the evidence required to charge somebody. And that is the challenge. As you rightly say, in the public's eye when they read that story that so-and-so has been arrested.
He's a wrong un. He's finished.
And exactly. So that's why our commissioner has taken the stance he has. I think it's perfectly possible to do that and still allow exceptions where there's a clear policing purpose between identifying somebody. But that's the line he's taken. And it would be helpful to see, I think, a more debate around that, particularly as we have a big public inquiry coming up at which people will be coming forward with stories of abuse in institutions or wherever. That has the potential to see more individuals being identified. And I think that is going to be quite challenging for the media in terms of how they deal with that.
You're not allowed to say in your answer that there is no typical day, but what is a typical day like for you?
Well, I can tell you how my day begins, which is by looking at the coverage of the Met Police across print, across broadcast, across social, and see what people are saying and identify whether there are any issues that we need to respond to immediately, even in the morning's broadcast media, for example. So that's very important. The part of my job that daily news journalists would recognise is we have a newsroom where we're taking calls from journalists all the time, and it's very like a newspaper newsroom or a broadcast newsroom.
Busy.
Lots coming in pretty much every day. Something's going to happen and people are going to turn around and say, OK, what are we going to do about this? Do we respond in this way or that way? So the buzz, the rhythm is very much like a daily journalism newsroom. Now, I'm not always part of that process. I have other strategic responsibilities as well. That includes internal communications and engaging our leaders. And Met has a huge program of organizational change. We've got to save a lot of money. We've got to police in a very different way. And to do that, we need to help our leaders. And in particular, we need to change the culture of the organization. So we have, I think, one of the most exciting internal comms challenges of any organization in the country. And my team is privileged to work a lot with our senior leaders. How do we engage our own rank and file officers around that process? Because anybody who does change communications will tell you that you've got to have a dialogue in the organization. Fine. Dialogue's quite difficult in organizations with a very hierarchical structure. The boss's word normally goes. So if that's your culture, how do you enable a conversation to take place where people can challenge the nature of the change or say, hang on a moment, boss, I think there's a different way to do it. And we've done a lot of work with our leaders trying to facilitate that kind of conversation and encourage officers and staff at all levels of the organisation to be part of that process. Right now, I'm spending a lot of work, a lot of time dealing with that. And then also I have a marketing team to look after as well. And the marketing challenge facing an organisation like the Met is fascinating. At one extreme, we are trying to recruit people from all different communities in London. At the other end of it, we have run campaigns to try to counter radicalization from terrorists overseas and engage with partners, engage with communities to challenge some of the propaganda, if you like, that comes out of terrorist organizations. So it's a very different challenges. Right now, we're building our insight into the people who use the Met service, because we're going increasingly digital. And like any organization, we need to build insight and understanding to help our customers use these new channels so that we give them absolutely the service we want. And then finally, I should just say I will also spend a bit of my time, and I have today, engaging with the teams who edit and produce our intranet, which is really important in a big organization with 50,000 people. We generate lots of content every day. We need a networked organization where people can collaborate and share ideas and work together. And we have a really important internet as well. And our digital content is really important to us. We have about 8.5 million members of the public in London who may have cause to interact with the Met. And we're really working hard to try and improve the offering we give them online, so that they can get the information they're looking for, if necessary, solve a problem themselves, or find the right person to talk to in the Met. So it's an extraordinary variety of things to do there. But of course, I also sit on the Met's management board, so I can't just see myself as dealing with the communications aspect. I share a responsibility with my colleagues for dealing with all the issues that we face.
Wow, you have a dizzying array of responsibilities.
Well, and a lot of my colleagues do who run communications and other big organisations. So I wouldn't claim that my challenge is any more difficult or unique. But I make the point, I suppose, just to illustrate that it's not just about media. If you're in a very big organization, if you're in a communications role, you have a responsibility and an opportunity to help people communicate with each other a lot better. You need to be thinking really hard about what your digital strategy is. And if, like me, you also run the marketing team, that brings with it another set of responsibilities. So it's a fascinating place to work. And I think for anybody who's contemplating a career in communications, they should think of places like the Met or indeed other police services as an opportunity to get a very quick introduction to a whole range of different challenges. And perhaps I'll leave this with you as a final thought. Policing is all about crises. Any 999 call is an individual crisis for somebody or other. And how you resolve that challenge is always going to be very difficult. It's very emotional for people. There are victims, there are witnesses, there are people under suspicion, and there are people who get convicted. And so there's a lot of conflict there. There's a lot of tension. And police stories, as a result, don't usually finish without everyone lived happily ever after. Because somebody's going to be sent to prison at the end of it. Or somebody may be acquitted and they're not going to be very happy about that. Or we may be unable to find a perpetrator. So we have an unhappy victim who doesn't feel that justice has been done. And for a whole set of other reasons, people may feel uncomfortable with what we've done. You know, police have coercive powers. The power of arrest is a really significant power and it has to be used wisely and in accordance with a really strict set of rules, which we do. And with all of those issues coming together, you won't get a better insight into all the varying aspects of communicating with the public or communicating with a large organisation in anywhere other than a place like the Met Police.
Martin, I knew in advance that I would find this interview absolutely fascinating, and you didn't let me down. I've hugely enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. I enjoyed it.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!